Good morning. Greet you all in Jesus' name. This morning, I've been blessed to be here this morning in the devotional, the start, and this devotional Sunday school, all tied in very well with my thoughts this morning, what I want to share for a message. But before we get into the message, I want to get our minds started. I want to ask a question and maybe take you to an introductory passage before I go to the passage that I want to preach from. You know, in the spiritual battle that we're fighting, that we're all a part of, we have many, many enemies. And aside from Satan, the most obvious enemy of our soul, what would be the biggest threat to us personally, as Christians, individuals, and to the church? What would you say is the biggest threat today to the church? Is it the ungodly influence in the world system that we read about in Revelation 18? The pressures, the influence on young people, the styles, Hollywood. You know, maybe we would say it's technology, which is a real big snare today, like in no other time in history. We face challenges. People are falling all around us and getting ensnared in things through the sins of technology. Or maybe it's tied in with the Sunday school lesson on wealth. The Bible says the love of money is the root of all evil. Luxury. Maybe for the youth, it's the pleasures of this life. Sports. Recreation. I don't know what you would say would be our greatest enemy today. Now, these are all real threats that I mentioned here this morning. But I think there's something much bigger that is tied to all of these things that I have mentioned. It's a much bigger threat to us today. And it's a stumbling block that takes more people away from God than probably anything else. I'd like you to turn, if you care to Mark chapter 7, and this is, I'll just introduce the thought here, verse 21-23. Jesus is talking with the Pharisees here, and I don't believe I'm taking this out of context too much. I think the Pharisees were talking maybe about, you know, the washing of hands and things like that. But these are the words of Jesus. This is what he said. From within, out of the heart, men proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lasciviousness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within and defile the man. You know, it is not these things that are without that are our biggest threat in life. It's the things that come from within. And that's probably the biggest thrust of my message this morning, is to just remind us of that basic fact. You know, often we get caught up in the symptoms and the things that come out of the from within. And we forget the source of where these things are coming from. Another thing I want to say before I forget, that I would not be being honest to try to portray or to say that I'm a good example in this. This message has been on my heart for, I don't know, maybe months, a couple months. And I feel a need of it. It's not that I feel like I have at all arrived. I think maybe it is for me, and I hope that you can benefit from it. It's things that I have been thinking about. And so for the actual passage, you can turn to Matthew 16. Is where I want to focus most of our thoughts out of. And there's two scenes here between Peter and Jesus. And I want to read both scenes. two different conversations. And I'm going to start at verse 15. He said unto them, "But whom say ye that I am?" And Simon Peter answered and said, "Thou art Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered and said unto him, "Blessed art thou, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood hath not revealed it unto thee, but my Father which is in heaven. And I say unto thee, thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. And I will give unto thee the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatsoever thou shalt bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatsoever thou shalt loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Scene 2 starts at verse 20. "Then charged he his disciples that they should tell no man that he was Jesus the Christ. From that time forth began Jesus to show unto his disciples how that he must go unto Jerusalem and suffer many things of the elders and the chief priests and the scribes, and be killed and be raised again the third day. Then Peter took him and began to rebuke him, saying, Be it far from thee, Lord, this shall not be unto thee. But he turned and said unto Peter, Get thee behind me, Satan, thou art an offense unto me, for thou savorest not the things that be of God, but those that be of men. Then said Peter unto his disciples, If any man will come after me, let him deny himself, and take up his cross, and follow me. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it, and whosoever shall lose his life for my sake shall find it. For what is it a man profit if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? For the Son of Man shall come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and then he shall reward every man according to his works." Scott Berkey talked about hard sayings of Jesus and the reactions of people. And I would feel like the verse I want to focus on, verse 24, is another one of those hard sayings of Jesus. He said, "If any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." Before we go into that verse much more, I'd like you to just think just a little bit about these two scenes that we read here and the context of where this verse is at. You know, what is going on here? In the first section here, you know, Peter is talking with Jesus, and Jesus was asking his disciples, "Who do men say that I am?" And Peter answered, "You are Jesus." And Jesus was blessing him and calling him the rock and telling him that I'm going to build my church off of you or this belief. But just a few minutes later, appears to be calling Peter Satan. "Get thee behind me, Satan." Strong language. If it was from anyone else, it would probably not be accepted. Why did Jesus say this? Why was he so strong in this saying? It seems like a pretty harsh rebuke for what Peter was trying to tell Jesus. You know, I think that we can all actually understand what Peter was, his true heart here, what he was doing. His heart wasn't to be working against Jesus, I don't believe, to be hindering the work of the kingdom and his church. Now, I think Peter's heart was true. You see the kind of personality that he was. It just came out, what he felt. I think his intentions were good. In fact, he was trying to help and defend Jesus. He loved Jesus. He did not want to see someone that he loved go through these things that Jesus was telling him that he needed to go through in Jerusalem, to suffer many things and to be killed, to rise again. Peter was just trying to help, trying to find another way. You know, surely there's another way other than suffering and torture that Jesus was talking about at the hands of the chief priests and the scribes. But Peter had a lot to learn at that point, what it really meant to be a follower of Jesus. So we have these emotional words of Jesus, "Get thee behind me, Satan. Thou art an offense to me." I think possibly one of the reasons Jesus seems like he had so much emotion in that is that these feelings that Peter was expressing Peter was talking about were very likely things that Jesus had been struggling with already. The temptations that Jesus had been battling with inside his own heart. You know, he had went out into the wilderness and he fasted for 40 days and prayed and was tempted. And we read over that and we don't know what all it was involved in those days. I mean, those temptations, they look like they happened in a minute or two and were over. We don't know the agony that Jesus went through in those temptations at that time. But I think at the heart of all three of those temptations was what Jesus was wrestling with in that temptation was self. Is he going to follow self or is he going to follow his heavenly Father? It was a battle between his desires. He was man. He was God in flesh. He was just like me and you in that sense. And so I think he had possibly worked through these things, and in his heart he knew what he needed to do. He knew what God was asking him to do. And God said to Jesus, you know, in those times, he said, Jesus said to God, "Not my will, but thine be done." And we see that later on, then after this passage that I'm reading, that Jesus was praying in agony in the garden when he was getting towards the end. And three times he went and he asked the Father, "Is there some other way? Is there another way that we can do this?" And God's reply was, "No. There's no other way around the cross, but my grace is sufficient for you." It was a desperate battle with self. And I think that maybe that was why Jesus was so emotionally charged about this. You know, he had struggled through this in his heart. And he didn't need his own dear people encouraging him, even though it was out of the goodness of their heart, in the wrong direction and tempting him in some other way. And you know, we, with our tenderheartedness, our good intentions at times, I think, we're just like Peter. We tend to be, if we're not careful. We reach out to people. We try to help them in their struggles and their battle with self. And maybe you can just tell it. They're just wore down and you're just not sure if they're going to make it. They might walk away any time. On the brink of defeat and about to give up. And we desperately want to help them, someone we love. And we're tempted to relieve the pain and try to help them find some way to navigate their way through this, an easier way, a way that if we talk enough, if we say it the right way, maybe we can get them to stay. They won't leave. We try to broaden the way a bit around the death to self. And our intentions are good. We mean well. But we are not doing each other favors when we do this. We are discouraging. It's the work of Satan to try to find another way. Yes, we need compassion. We need to come alongside. We need to encourage. We need to help. We need to pray for one another and carry the loads. But we must be very careful to lead each other to the cross, to self-denial. Denying ourselves and taking up our cross is actually where the power is. It sounds backwards. And I wish I had more experience in this, but when we give up ourselves truly, that's when the power comes. And there's a verse that says that. You know, as long as we are making deals and negotiating and bargaining with self, we live a powerless life. We struggle with victory. If we're going to have the resurrection power, we're going to have to die. There's no way around it. 1 Corinthians 1:18 says, "For the preaching of the cross is to them that perish foolishness, but unto us which are saved it is the power of God." There we see it. It's the power. That's where the power comes. So often we're like Peter. Jesus said, "Thou savorest the things that be of men." Or, "Thou savorest not the things that be of God, but those that be of men." It doesn't make sense. It's foolish. It's backwards in our human way of thinking. We see it all around us. There's confusion. There's turmoil. There's people that just struggle and struggle and struggle for years with the same thing. And they get tired. And I think it's an effort to find a way for self and to find a way for the cross and denial on the same path. And it's tiring. It's wearing. It does not work. And that is what modern Christianity often, it seems like, often falls into. People love Jesus. They love His cross. You know, I don't think we run over that word cross and we have no idea what that meant to Jesus. In that day, the cross was a tremendous, the crucifixion, source of torture. It was extremely painful, and it was slow. It was intended that way. It wasn't just to get rid of a guy. You know, go out and shoot him and get rid of him. It was to torture that guy. And they would hang on that cross for maybe over a day at times, just suffering. And along with that, part of that was for the people that were watching. So that they would drive home the lesson to whoever is watching, whatever that guy was doing, if you follow him, that's what you'll be doing. And it drove the fear into those people, I believe. Excruciating, we talk about. Excruciating pain. And that comes from that word, crucify. It was excruciating. It was also not only painful to the body, it was a humiliation. You hung up there helpless before man, walking before you, and suffering, open for all to see. And you know, Jesus knew all this. When he said these words, he hadn't been there yet, but he knew it was coming. And he told these people, and you can understand why Peter was hesitant and was trying to talk him out of another way. I imagine those people in those days, Peter and Jesus, had witnessed this. People hanging on the cross and the suffering. And so it's no wonder that Peter was not ready to accept this. So often we like his cross. We're thankful that Jesus died on the cross. But when it comes to denying ourself and our cross, we're not interested. We don't want to hear it. We don't want to embrace the cross. There's a couple of verses I want to read about this. And I'm just going to keep moving, so if you want to look them up, you can. Philippians 3, 18 and 19. Verse 18, "For many walk, of whom I have told you often, and now tell you even weeping, that they are the enemies of the cross of Christ." What did it mean here? Okay, the next verse explains it. Who are these enemies of Christ? Verse 19, "Whose end is destruction, whose God is their belly, whose glory is their shame, who mind earthly things." Those were the enemies of Christ. And you know, Revelation 18 that we read in devotions, and the Sunday school lesson, I agreed, I appreciated, I think, the thoughts about money, wealth, luxury. But I think we need to add a clause maybe to our statement that it's really the heart. It's the heart that matters in the end. And it really does. But finally, there is at some point fruit from our heart that comes forth. And you see that in Revelation 18. And that was kind of the one thought that I wanted you to get. I don't know if you noticed, but at the beginning of that chapter, it talks about the sin of Babylon. But then when you read down through that whole chapter, there's not one gross sin, we would say, as in just sin in itself, in that whole chapter that we read, besides the fornication with the city. It was all, you hear the word precious a lot, which is an indication of the heart. But it was just sticks and stones and sheep and animals and builders and ships. But all those men in the end were weeping and wailing. Why? It was where their heart was. And it was an indication of where their heart was, their response. I think that we need, in addition to that, I think that we need to realize that I think when Jesus was talking about denying self, it was a lot more than sins, like the sin of murder and the sin of adultery and anger and all those things. It's the very core of who we are, and our will, maybe, is self. And so often we'll analyze something and we'll say, well, is it sin? We just look at it with tunnel vision, and it's not in the Bible that this word is sin. But do we look at the big picture? Do we look at where this thing takes us? What it does to my heart, which direction it leads me? There's some verses I want to read in relation to this. In 1 Corinthians 6:12 and 1 Corinthians 10:23, it says, "All things are lawful unto me, but all things are not expedient. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be brought under the power of any." And another verse 23 of chapter 10, "All things are lawful for me, but all things are not expedient. All things are lawful for me, but all things edify not." Just to drive that point home. There's many good things. The saying is, the good is the enemy of the best. And if we fill our lives with things that are less than what God wants for us, they may be good things. But if my wife is at home and I'm off golfing or hunting too much, at some point, those things become weights in our spiritual life. They're not bad, but they weight us down. And they drag us down, and we keep adding those things to our lives. And so in that sense, they become sin. There's a poem, I guess it is, I want to read here. I don't know if any of you have read it. It goes with Revelation 18 and this thought of self. It's called "The Church Walking with the World." Could I have some water, please, Joel? "The church and the world walked far apart on the changing shores of time. The world was singing a giddy song and the church a hymn sublime. 'Come, give me your hand,' said the merry world, 'and walk with me this way.' But the good church hid her snowy hand and solemnly answered, 'Nay, I will not give you my hand at all. I will not walk with you. Your way is the way that leads to death. Your words are all untrue.' 'Nay, walk with me but a little space,' said the world with a kindly air. 'The road I walk is a pleasant road, and the sun shines always there. Your path is thorny and rough and rude, but mine is broad and plain. My way is paved with flowers and dew, and yours with tears and pain. The sky to me is always blue. No want, no toil, I know. The sky above you is always dark. Your lot is a lot of woe. There's room enough for you and me to travel side by side.' Half shyly the church approached the world and gave him her hand of snow. And the old world grasped it and walked along, saying in accents low, 'Your dress is too simple to please my taste. I will give you pearls to wear, rich velvets and silks for your graceful form, and diamonds to deck your hair.' The church looked down at her plain white robes and then at the dazzling world and blushed as she saw his handsome lip with a smile contemptuous curled. 'I will change my dress for a costlier one,' said the church with a smile of grace. Then her pure white garments drifted away and the world gave in their place. Beautiful satins and shining silks, roses and gems and costly pearls, while over her forehead her bright hair fell crisp in a thousand curls. 'Your house is too plain,' said the proud old world. 'I'll build you one like mine, with walls of marble and towers of gold and furniture ever so fine.' So he built her a costly and beautiful house, most splendid it was to behold. Her sons and her beautiful daughters dwelt there, gleaming in purple and gold. Rich fairs and shows in the halls were held, and the world and her children were there. Laughter and music and feasts were heard in a place that was meant for prayer. There were cushions cushioned seats for the rich and the gay to sit in their pomp and pride, but the poor were clad in shabby array, sat meekly down outside. You give too much to the poor, said the world, far more than you ought to do. If you are in need, if they are in need of shelter and food, why need it trouble you? Go take your money and buy rich robes, buy horses and chariots fine. By pearls and jewels and dainty food, by the rarest and costliest wine. My children, they dot on these things, and if you their love would win, you must do as they do and walk in their ways that they are walking in. So the poor were turned from her doors in scorn, and she heard not the orphan's cry, but she drew her beautiful robes aside as the widows went weeping by. Then the sons of the world and the sons of the church walked closely hand and heart, and only the Master, who knew all, could tell the two apart. Then the church sat down at her ease and said, I am rich and my goods increase. I have need of nothing or ought to do but laugh and dance and feast. The sly world heard and he laughed in his sleeve and mockingly said, set aside, the church is fallen, the beautiful church, and her shame is her boast and her pride. The angel drew near to the mercy seat and whispered in sighs her name. Then the loud anthem of rapture was hushed, and the heads were covered with shame. The voice was heard at last by the church from him who sat on the throne. I know thy works, and hast thou said, I am rich, and hast not known that thou art naked, poor and blind, and wretched before my face. Therefore from thy presence cast I thee out, and blot thy name from its place. The church walking with the world. Who is the world? Maybe we need to think about that a little bit. I think we need to remember that Jesus said the battle is from within. We so easily turn and we look at the threats, and that's right. But the battle truly is from within. I believe the statement that it is where the heart is that ultimately leads us. It's not the volume, it's not the flow, it's where the heart is. Think just a little bit more about self. Self is so resilient and robust and irrepressible. You know, I think that's why Paul says I must die daily. It is just one of those things. It's a brother or twin to pride, self. It's just something that we have to always deal with. You push it down, you deny it, you die to it, and it comes right back. I remember years ago a preacher saying, self is willing. It gives you this thought of negotiation that we do in our deceit part. Self is willing to get down on its hands and knees and crawl for miles, but it will not die. It does not want to die. It starts at a very young age. You see it in our children grabbing and saying, give me, and taking. The flesh and self manifests itself in all kinds of ways and forms and masks. And so often we, like was already mentioned, it's the symptoms that we see and that we deal with. And if we forget that it's us, you know, it's my child's friend that is contaminating my child. It's within. And maybe to bring this back around, often self, we think of self, and like Elmer said, wealth is riches. But self, in differing from riches, in a way has nothing to do with the amount that you have of things. You know, some of the most selfish people have nothing but the clothes on their back and live under a bridge. And that's where they want to be. They are living and serving self. It is not measured by the things that we have, again. Another thing about people, as you look around, politicians, the sports world, they're unashamedly promoting themselves. They'll put their names and faces on signs and talk about themselves, how wonderful they are. And you know, we would never do that. That's not our problem. You won't see any of ourselves campaigning for anything. Now, we were much too trained to do that. We will camouflage it to where at least we're blind to it ourselves. you think of just about any sin or vice in your life, and there's a very good chance that it's coming back to the root of selfishness. You know, overeating, gluttony, it's nothing but selfishness, the sin of gluttony, overspending, whether listening to things we shouldn't or watching movies that we shouldn't. It's a selfish desire. It's a symptom of myself. Anger. People aren't doing it how I want it, when I want it, and we get angry. It's not going my way. Pornography is an extremely selfish, self-centered thing. You know, and maybe we think of it always as those sins again. But I just want to repeat that it is not a respecter of persons. It plagues the conservative people. It plagues the people on the mission field. There's selfishness is there. It's in our marriages. It's in our churches. It's just something that we need to be aware of. And I'm amazed at sometimes at myself or just what's accepted as okay in because of whatever practices and in selfish acts that we do in my own heart. Sometimes we'll do unselfish deeds for selfish purposes. That doesn't take long for the old human body to calculate that. My little son can do that. You say the first shall be last and the last shall be first. And well, then I'll get in the back of the line because I want to be first is still the goal. It's not a heart of denying self. In 2 Timothy 3, we have, it talks about the last days. And I don't know what you think of when you think about people in the last days. Often we think of Sodom and Gomorrah wickedness, gay marriages, abortion, just wicked things. But in 2 Timothy 3, we have some verses there. And the very first thing that he says, this also know in the last days, perilous times shall come. And he says, for men shall be lovers of their own selves. That's the first thing. Just lovers of your own self. What I want to do. Then it goes on to say, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, and it lists other things. But then again, it kind of comes back to that. At the end of the list, it says lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. Almost all of these things fit, possibly, their heart conditions into a well-raised Mennonite church member. To be a lover of myself, to be proud, to be disobedient to my parents. Those are things that are possible. They're issues of the heart. Self. Okay. Verse 5 ends in that. Then I wanted to read that. It says, having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof, from such turn away. There's form, but no power. It's people, I suppose, in the church, because the people outside the church aren't trying to have form. It looks good. Nice things, nice clothes, nice ways of doing it. A form of godliness, no power to live above self and to follow Jesus. It almost seems right, but it's a counterfeit. It doesn't ring true. So we've talked about self. What's the remedy to self? Jesus said, if any man will come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. We come back to those words that Jesus said. And he goes on to say, if any man's going to save his life, he'll have to lose it. And in another passage, it talks about Jesus takes, and I brought a kernel. He uses an illustration for the children, but really probably mostly for the adults. There's a kernel. You probably can't even see it in the back. It's a kernel of popcorn. Jesus said, that is like your life. You have options. We can do a couple things with this thing. You can preserve it, and it can go out and it can enjoy life and just stay like this all its life. Or there's another option. This kernel has potential to bring forth hundreds more of these, that maybe thousands of these kernels. But there's only one way for that kernel to do that, Jesus said. It must go underground, buried, and die. It can't have it both ways. It needs to decide what it's going to do with its life. It must die. We can save our life or we can lose it. We can preserve self or we can die to self. You know, these commandments, people, and I understand, I've said the same thing, you know, I don't understand or I'm confused. I don't quite know what I should do. But the commandments of Jesus, the thing about them, unless you really do the interpretation thing, they're usually pretty simple. They're pretty easy to understand. The catch is obeying them. That's where it's really hard. And sometimes I wonder, and I want to say this carefully because I'm not a guy against counseling. But sometimes I wonder if all the counseling that goes on that we need is simply that. Did you ever think about and wonder about why there's so many diets to lose weight? Why don't they just say quit eating food and exercise and you'll lose weight? Well, it hurts. It's uncomfortable. I get hungry. And so we have pills. We have all kinds of things, surgeries. And I know there's health things, so I'm not talking about that. But denying of self. And sometimes counseling is good. It's a wonderful tool to a sincere heart to shepherd and to bring them. But all the counseling in the world will not bring a person to death, to self, to the cross. I think that's something that we need as individuals need to recognize. This battle within, it's myself, it's me against the will of God is what's going on. Follow me. That's the positive part of Jesus' message. If anyone will come after me, he denies, he dies, takes up the cross, and follows me. What does it mean to follow Jesus? I think following, one thing is that it's a path. It's a continuation. It's not a one-time event, and then we're good. It's a daily path that we must walk and choices that we make every day. Is it going in the direction of Jesus? Is these little decisions, these big decisions, where are they leading me? In Jesus' day, they had the rabbis, and that's what Jesus was, and they had the disciples that followed the rabbis. And a disciple was not like we think of in a classroom, a student. The rabbi stands in front of the student and lectures, and the student gets head knowledge and goes home. It was a rabbi that shepherded, and the disciples followed. They tried to emulate him. They walked in his footsteps, went where he went, and followed in that way. Probably everyone here would say, do you want to follow Jesus? You would say yes, if you're a sincere Christian. You know, what are we saying? Do we understand what it means to follow Jesus? How do we make our decisions? How do I know if I am following Jesus today? How do we find God's will for our lives? And I think our biggest enemy, just to keep hammering this point, is our own self. You know, we're guided by our own self. Me, I, what I want. And we hear these phrases and we all say them at times, and it's not always wrong. I don't like this. I don't want this. I do want this. I don't feel like doing this. It's not always wrong. But if you listen close to what people are saying, often in decisions in life, through all the talk and the counsel, it finally circles back to around to what I want. What I want in life. What is guiding me? It's practical. It's easy to say, I want to be where God wants me to be, and I want to be in His will. I want to serve the Lord with all my heart. I don't know if I should bring this up because I don't want to put a negative on it at all, but I just thought of this last week. We had a meeting on Wednesday night about outreach. You know, there's decisions to be made. And we all are, you know, we look into the future and there's a certain amount of uncertainty and fearfulness that we face in these things. But how are you, how am I going to ultimately decide if I'm going to be a part of this? On what premise, on what basis will I be willing? And I believe fully that God is asking some to stay here. And that's okay. I believe that's God's will. But are you willing to open your life up? Are you willing to allow God to show you? Another question I'd have is, how would God show you? If we say the statement, I want to be where God wants me to be, and I'll go if He wants me to go, how would God get through to us? Is there a method besides a voice from heaven that would get our attention? I think we need to be honest. And sometimes it's hard for us to be honest. Sometimes we need the help of other people to help us be honest. Because our hearts are deceitful. And often we say those words, but then just subconsciously we build ourselves an airtight, soundtight room where unless there's an act of God, the decision is made. And, you know, I understand the vulnerability. I'm not dying to go on an outreach, necessarily. But I think that our heart needs to be dying to self. Is self going to make this decision? Or are we going to at least allow God to speak into my life? And this probably one of the most scary things about it is that God will allow you to make your decision. You can say no for the wrong reasons, or you can go for the wrong reasons for that matter. And God will not force you. He will let you live as you choose. Are we willing to surrender? The path to Jesus. Thinking about the path that He walked, I was trying to think, okay, to follow Jesus and some practical things. You know, His life was a life of surrender. It really was. He did not do the things He in the flesh wanted to do. He would say, not my will, but thine be done. Jesus was a servant. The characteristics of a servanthood, being a servant, is probably one of the best antidotes to a selfish life. If you're a servant, a true servant, not just acts a servant, but strive to be a servant, to put others first, to care about how they feel and what they think. Humility, to not think so highly of ourselves and to be arrogant and proud and think we have it together. That was the path that Jesus walked day by day. And it's not a one-time decision. It's a path that we walk daily. Philippians 2:7-8, He made Himself of no reputation and took upon Him the form of a servant and was made in the likeness of men. And being found in fashion as a man, He humbled Himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. You know, Jesus' life wasn't based on what He felt like doing that day. If we're going to do what we feel like doing, we're going to be in trouble. And as I thought of the heroes of faith from that same angle, you know, we enjoy that chapter 11 of Hebrews. We admire those guys. But they didn't get there by doing what they felt like doing. We need to think about that. You know, Moses, you think he wanted to suffer with the children of Israel rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin? Was that just something he naturally went that way? No, it was a conscious choice that he made against his own flesh. Noah, you know, he built an ark and put up with the mocking and the making fun for 100 years. Not because he enjoyed it. It wasn't what he chose. It was what he was asked to do. Abraham, I'm sure, didn't get up and just pack up and head out somewhere for not knowing where he went because he thought it sounded fun either. These men went in faith. They had to die to self. They did these things for a cause bigger than their own small, selfish wants and desires and ambitions. And I think each one in their own unique way, although they lived before Christ, they denied themselves and took up their cross and followed Him. I'll end with a little story that I think kind of is can bring out a point here on self-denial, giving up a self. It's a story, the story of a man on a long journey in the desert. As he walked through the desert, he became hot and thirsty, and he used up all his water as he traveled along. So he was thirsty, he had no water. After a while, he came to this old water hand pump. When he got there, it was dry and squeaky, wouldn't work. But he spied at the base of the pump a note. So he picked it up, and this is what it said. Under the heap of sand to your right, there is a bottle of water. Dig the bottle of water out, pour it down the pump. This will prime the pump and moisten the gaskets. Pump all the water you need. There is plenty of water. When you are done, fill the bottle and bury it in the same place that you found it, so that all that follow you can quench their thirst as well. And then there was a warning. It said, you will be tempted to disbelieve this and to consume the bottle of water yourself. If you do this, soon you will be thirsty again, and all that follow your steps will be thirsty. You know, each one of us have that bottle of water. And it's a risk. It's a gamble. You're thirsty. If you pour that thing down there and the pump doesn't pump, you have no water. You can preserve it. You can drink it. We are all that bottle of water. What are we going to do with it? Are we going to drink it? Or are we going to pour ourselves out for a cause bigger than ourselves? Thank you for your attention. Let's have a song.